I'm slightly surprised by. I mean, for example, I will have a live cricket match on. But for some reason, they may be showing a live cricket match, and I find I'm not that obsessed with watching it. I just want to know what happens. What's the score is the important thing.
Yeah,
it's rather like these football fans who say, yeah, all right, very nice approach play, but has there been a goal? It's a bit like that. And what just following cricket on Cricketfo, I find very satisfying. Mm. I think also what I like is that I don't like the feeling of being completely overwhelmed by the thing of being a sports fan. I like the idea of having it on and doing something else. And Cricketfo, which is silent, and you can keep on going back after 20 minutes, you know, oh, I wonder what the score is, whether they've taken a wicket, whatever. I find that very satisfying. The idea of sport in kind of weaving in and out of real life, I find very pleasing.
Do you think one of the things about, I mean, cricket has the advantage here in that it's very definite about what's happening. And whereas, you know, 20 minutes worth of football, if there isn't a goal, it's actually all opinion.
Yes.
As to whether that was a good chance, a bad chance, who's playing well, who's playing badly,
I think cricket fits into the computer age to perfection. You've got this constant stream of definite events.
Yeah.
Right down to whether he scored a run off this ball. Bang, there it is. Whereas with the other sports, you can feel them almost inventing events. Descriptions, I mean, they talk about assists in football, don't they now?
Yeah, that's an idea that came from some American sport, but the Americans have always been great on stats.
Yeah,
and they love that. Probably ice hockey, I think. The idea that probably came from. They've even started to introduce this thing called the expected goal. Now this is I love this. I absolutely adore this new stat, and what it is someone looked at 300,000 incidents or goal-scoring opportunities, and they did the stats and the number crunch, and they worked out for any given incident what the actual chances are of scoring are. And if you apply this to goal-scoring opportunities in a game, you can come up with how many goals should have been scored.
Oh, I see. So you can actually nail down that the intuition that you often have, that, you know, Watford had no business beating Manchester United, but they did.
Yeah, you can indeed.
And there was a rugby match last weekend, which I must say I did enjoy watching. England beat Australia after there was about 70 minutes when there was nothing between the teams, and if anything, Australia were better. And the last few moments, England scored 3 tries, and the result was 36 to England. And the Australian manager was hardly able to speak afterwards for fear of what he might say. I mean, there'd been apparently perfectly reasonable tries disallowed for the Australians.
Right. I don't know if this stat could be done, because. And one of the problems with a try is a very definite event.
Well,
you know, it's
you say that, but well, the decision makes it definite.
I mean, in football, you take the moment when the player strikes the ball, and you can say what are the chances of him scoring.
Oh, I see. Yes.
But with rugby, well, if he's over the line carrying the ball, well, that's 100% chance of scoring a try, more or less. Mm. And if he's not over the line...
Well, it's fun when that isn't true. When
they cock it all up.
Unopposed cock-ups, yes. Good fun. But what is the fascination of sport? Let's be clear. Television has made a colossal impact on sport by transforming the fortunes of sportsmen. So that, you know, a really successful Premier League footballer, he gets a stately home, you know, and that means that the games themselves become, will this bloke make it and get a stately home, or will he have to go fuck off and be a doorman? You know, that's the stakes in football are so high.
But so when some kid, are they? I mean, the fact is, if you know, it's a stately home or a slightly smaller stately home.
No, that's but really what the... I mean is that no, no, because in sport, you can feel that this was a key moment. Like when you score your first goal in the Premier League, that's a breakthrough moment. It's got to be.
But
you're some teenager. But you're playing.
But scoring a goal, you know, on a five-a-side on a wet Wednesday evening, it also feels pretty good.
Yes, but it must feel better if you do it against Liverpool.
I'm sure it does, yes.
At Anfield, yes. In your first game, yeah. Playing for Coventry or somebody, you know, or Watford, forgive me. That's your team. What I mean is that you sports fans all know that was a big moment, or this is a big moment. In cricket, one of the great things about cricket is you know that this innings, this man's whole career is on the line here. I wrote a whole piece about on Samisdata about an England cricketer called Adam Lyth who was playing in the Ashes. And the entire ground knew that if he got out for a small score in this game, that was it. He was going to be dropped and there was no likelihood that he'd be picked again. And well, in fact, he has not been picked again.
I wonder if this is...
That is stately home versus dormant.
Well, maybe it's a cricket thing.
Maybe it is.
Because
maybe that's one of the fascinations of cricket.
Because
a batsman, it's so final, isn't it? You can be out first ball and that's your day done.
As football, I can't think of any examples. But football, if you don't make it for Man United, okay, maybe you're good enough for Everton.
Yes.
That sort of thing. But and yes, there is a gap there, but it's not that. It's not like the difference between playing Test cricket and playing county cricket. Mm. I don't know the sums, but my guess is county cricket is getting on for semi-professional.
Mm.
Whereas test cricket...
It's certainly quite a financial sacrifice that you get posh boys playing county cricket for two or three seasons to see if they can make it. And if they reckon they're not going to, then that's it. They bugger off and become
doing proper job.
Hedge fund managers, you know.
Although you do wonder why it is that posh boys still haven't made it into football. Or maybe they have in foreign countries.
They've made it... In foreign countries they have, because all the managers in England seem to be foreign posh boys.
Mm. You can tell a foreigner is posh, can you?
I can't. A foreigner can be posh? They're quite well educated. I mean, Arsene Wenger knows who Sigmund Freud was, doesn't he? Don't you think? If not, he does a very good impersonation of knowing such things.
You've got a French accent, you can do that.
Yes.
Although I did hear a story about... someone was very surprised to go to an Italian club and find there was a library there.
I've heard this said many times about continental football, that it's played by highly superior types. Whereas, by and large, English football isn't. But my original point, or one of my points, that television has had a colossal effect upon sport. And sport is one of the facts of the modern world, isn't it? The way that millions of people seem to create the rhythm of their lives in accordance with their team getting promoted or their team winning the FA Cup or coming second in the Premier League or something. I can still remember that Spurs, my team, which I vaguely from a distance support, they had a reputation for only winning things in years beginning, ending with a one. Or
yeah. that, and then they didn't even do that.
Then they stopped doing that, yeah.
I mean, I wonder if it's because it is a fairly natural human emotion to be warlike.
I agree. I think it's all to do with the fact that war has diminished in the very rich and lucky countries. Mm-hmm. That's my strong belief. And it's almost as if the emotions that are aroused by war, tribal hatred and just shouting all at once, have gone into football.
Yeah.
From places in the culture where they used to exist, cavalry regiments and things.
So I suppose it begs the question, or raises the question, why was football still quite popular during the First World War?
Mm.
Well, I suppose it wasn't that popular. I mean, they did actually finish the league. That's quite late. But people were so used to fighting.
There's a very interesting book, which I haven't yet read, but it's... I've looked into it already, and it's about the culture clash within the Australian cricket team in 1948, which was captained by somebody who sat out the war, but contained players who'd been in the thick of it. Famously, Keith Miller was a fighter pilot, whereas equally famously, Don Bradman absolutely wasn't. And Don Bradman treated the tour as his personal war, and Keith Miller despised that. He, having taken part in a real war, said, "Don't be an arsehole. This is a game. Stop treating it like a war."
Mm.
It's a fascinating event. Tragically, that tour wasn't televised. I wish it had been.
So there's no surviving
footage. There are tiny little sort of, you know, black and white movie moments, fragments, but there's hardly anything.
And how did it resolve itself?
Oh, the Australians slaughtered England.
In spite or because of Bradman's...
I mean, Australians can have huge quarrels with each other, but they still seem to end up having a pretty good side. I think that's part of the appeal of sport, by the way, that it's a kind of ongoing soap opera. Don't you think?
Golly.
That you get...
There are various elements of the soap opera, aren't there? I mean, there are personalities and which manager is going to move where, and you know, which player is going to play. And
yeah, but who hates also so-and-so? The clubs themselves. And who's got into a fist fight on the training ground and all that stuff?
Yeah, yeah.
It's all good. And I noticed this as an outsider to football. I'm not really that bothered. I like it when Spurs win, but I often don't even notice. But I noticed that the sports pages of the evening papers in London are just as full of tittle-tattle on days when there's no actual match to report as when there is. I mean, they have a big discussion about, you know, whether Pochettino, whatever his name is going to go off and manage Real Madrid and what he thinks about doing that and so on. So it's a huge fascination. Football especially fits. I think perhaps one of the reasons cricket has suffered from TV is that it's taken a long time for it to reorganise itself in a way that is truly friendly to TV.
You mean T20?
Yeah, yeah. It's hard to imagine T20 having risen to the prominence it has without television. I mean, intrinsic to the Indian Premier League, which is the first big T20 national tournament where all the players in the world descend on it and get paid vast fortunes. That none of that happens without TV. It's the TV rights that make it all happen. What I'm getting at is TV is a huge... That reinforces the point about why the historians will talk about TV, because they'll also talk about sport, I'm convinced of it. They'll talk about the enormous prominence of sport in people's lives compared to what it felt like in, say, 1930, when, yes, there were sporting events, but everyone realised that there were other things more important, like the fact that this fellow Hitler was on his way on the up and up. What are we going to do about that? It gives you a sense of proportion, especially if, you know, half the England football team got killed in the last war, you know. And you know that if there's another war, then half of the next one's going to get killed. Really killed. Not killed metaphorically.
No.
Slaughtered them. Yeah. No, you didn't. You just beat them in a game. I mean, I remember one of my favourite moments of television that I can remember, and I remember watching this when it happened and thinking, that's going to be remembered, was when Boris Becker, who had, I think, won Wimbledon when he was very young.
Yeah.
I think the next year or something, he came back and he lost in the last 16 or something. And there was a press conference where it was talked about as if, you know, he'd just lost his baby daughter or something in a car accident. And that was the tone of voice of all the questions. You know, they were all terribly sympathetic. They were thinking maybe this teenager's going to burst into tears. And Boris Becker just said, look, nobody died. I lost a tennis match. That's all that happened. It was a wonderful, wonderful moment. Maybe that's one of the things about TV that's great. You get these moments, not whole shows that you watch week after week. Just, do you remember that time when so-and-so said that? Maybe that's one of the ways of thinking about TV. Another moment I love was when England were playing rugby against New Zealand. It was during the run-up to the 2005 World Cup, which England just managed to win. And they were playing playing in New Zealand against New Zealand. And the general feeling was, if England are going to win the World Cup, they're going to have to win games like this. And they did indeed beat New Zealand. And they did it with a goal line resistance, which is a big deal in rugby. And they had two blokes who'd been yellow carded. So there were 13 English guys holding off 15 New Zealanders. And they did it and they won.
Oh, yellow card means you get sent off?
Yellow card, 10 minutes. Sin-binned, as they call it.
Oh, sin-binned, okay.
And afterwards at the press conference, they asked Martin Johnson, the England captain, so what was going through your head, they said, during this battle? And he said, my spine. It was just gorgeous. That one hasn't been remembered by lots of people, but it should. It was a lovely little bit of
dialogue. I was going to say about this whole business about sin binning. I found that interesting. And my theory is that the smaller sports are much better at coming up with rule changes which make their sports often more attractive, mainly, but also fairer. I mean, I often complain about the whole business about yellow carding in football, because that affects, you know.
Well, yellow cards in football, you just stay on the pitch unless you get another one, don't you?
Yeah, you do.
You get a,
but they tot up and you get a suspension eventually.
Yeah.
But the point being that the beneficiary of that suspension is not the person you fouled in the first place. And it ought to be the person you fouled in the first place. Especially with it's also true of red cards. You get suspended, I think, for one or two games if you get sent off, depending on how bad the sending off is. But again, it's another person, another team that benefits, not the one you're playing.
What, because a really good player doesn't get to be picked, can't be picked for the next game?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I think there's a sense in which small sports, there's a feeling amongst all the people involved that they're sort of all on the same side, and that the good of their sport, the expansion of their sport, the idea that people who play that sport can get really rich, is something they're all united in attempting to achieve.
Yes.
Whereas with football, they are fighting for the spoils. And so it's harder to arrange agreements in football than it would be in badminton.
Yes. Interesting.
But again, this is the soap opera thing. The fact that you and I both get so well informed about these sports. I mean, TV is what determines that there is so much at stake in these games.
I mean, you don't think people in 100 years ago were...
Not as obsessed on such a scale, no.
I suppose one of the problems is it was very difficult if you lived in, say, Manchester to have an opinion on the Sheffield United football team, because you only saw it once
a year. For a long time, sport has been a way of avoiding utter tedium and misery in your life. It's been the classic escape for the working class into something a bit better. But now, it's like taking wing, financially speaking, going into space. It's like winning the pools. It's like winning the football pools. I mean, none of the England team that won the World Cup in 1966 ended up living in palaces, I don't think. Or if they did, it was because of other reasons.
Well, the one who would have been Jack Charlton, but that's because he managed...
But that's because he did well later, yes.
Yeah.
But none of them because of that one win. But now, I mean...
Even if they don't win a World Cup.
Yeah. Beckham never came anywhere near to winning a World Cup, did he? And yet he made an absolute killing.
Yes.
But also, but even with Beckham, actually, you have to say it's also because the man has a deep grasp of popular culture.
Yes.
He's not stupid. I don't care what people say.
No.
I mean, that again is television, because it's only because of TV that I've got a sense of what kind of a guy David Beckham is. I watched him being interviewed, and I've heard other people say the fact that he never says a word immediately after being asked a question, but he thinks about it, is evidence that he's stupid. I don't regard thinking about an answer before you give it as evidence of stupidity. And I never have. I don't think Beckham's stupid. I think he's a very shrewd man. I think one of the stupidities of quote-unquote clever people, like me, by the way, is that we confuse verbal fluency and the ability to give a witty, instant answer with wisdom. I think it's clever to be able to give a witty answer.
Well, I don't, because I'm no good at witty answers and instant replies, so I have to make and vainly think I'm quite wise, so I have to think like that. Well, yeah. I mean, it's the intelligence of David Beckham. Well, don't know. I mean, I...
No, never mind. What I'm getting at is that that sort of conversation that happens in pubs up and down the land, I'm sure, still, and on now in chat rooms or whatever they have these days, social media, that is all nourished by television. And in a bigger sense, what's happened to the world is that more and more of your significant others, that's to say, personalities that loom large in your life, tend to be distant celebrities rather than the people next door. There was a brief discussion.
Is that a good thing?
I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing, but it's a thing.
Hmm.
They were talking about, they had a big TV show about TV a few months back, and I watched it by way of homework for this stuff we're doing now. And it was David Attenborough who said what I've just said. He said that before television, you knew all the people in your little locality much better, but you didn't know about the wider world nearly so much. Now it's the other way around.
Except that people in more rural areas, mm-hmm. in my experience, tend to know their neighbours a lot better.
Yes, because they depend upon them far more.
Mm.
But there must be more places in England now where people just live. I think children bind communities together. But
yeah.
But a lot of towns are what you'd call dormitory towns, which captures exactly that sense of a whole bunch of people living in the same place, but not necessarily knowing each other very well. Actually, not like a dormitory, the opposite of a dormitory. And I think that's partly TV. I think David Attenborough was correct to identify TV as an agent of that sort of change, one of the reasons.
Well, I mean, we have to ask you, because I'm unaware of a world without television. Yes. You perhaps are.
I can just about remember it, yes.
So, you know, community spirit.
When I think about it, I had lots of local friends, but then I'm sure people do still have lots of local friends. So,
well, growing up as a child, you do, yes.
I think you need to be an adult before television to really clock what I'm talking about, which I think David Attenborough was. I think he's just older than me enough to remember TV when he was, or a world without TV when he was 20-something, I think. So I think he's the man who tells us this.
He must be about 90 now, mustn't he?
Something like that.
Yes. Of course, he was, if I remember correctly, the controller of BBC, the first controller of BBC Two.
Yes, I think.
And he was a young man then. Don't know.
Well, I mean, we could mention this whole wildlife TV thing.
I'm trying to see if there's an opposite. So I'm trying to play devil's advocate here. Is it possible that actually people were, there was a celebrity culture, there were other forms of culture, maybe other barriers to the sort of thing we were talking about before TV came along?
I think that's true. I think all these generalisations have to be qualified. Of course they do. I mean, ancient Rome had celebrities. And you've got to know what they looked like, apparently, by looking at coins, which is where they put their faces on them, apparently. The big cheeses put their faces on coins, and that's how people knew
You look at some of these images on coins, you think, no one looks like that. They do look comical.
They do. Often. They look very strange. But, yeah, sure, celebrities weren't invented by television. They had radio stars, for goodness sake.
Mm-hmm.
You know, music hall stars.
Yeah.
Yeah. Royal family's been going for a long time.
Indeed.
And high society. Debs. Gossip columns. All that.
Yes, in Parade's End, I think there's a mention of Tejas's wife being seen with another man and this being appearing in one of the magazines.
That's it.
This was terribly important in those days.
Mm.
I think it was a story about Edward Elgar, a photograph that appeared of him in the press, you know, caption being with his wife. It wasn't his wife.
What do we think of that then? Yes. Well, I mean, that makes the point that the media have been going for a long time.
Yeah.
It's not just television, or now, not just the internet. I wonder what difference it makes that... Here's a thought about TV, which is that in the early stages of TV, by and large, each household had only one TV and it was controlled by the owners of the household.
Oh, I remember now, that well enough, yes.
Now, every individual who really wants it can have a TV. In other words, TV used to bring the family together, like the openings, the openings of the credits of The Simpsons. They all arrive on the sofa in various different ways, but every time they end up watching the TV, all four of them. That world has gone, hasn't it, to some extent?
Yeah. It wasn't. I don't think it was mourned particularly.
Well, certainly, I think it maybe have been mourned by Dad and Mum, but not by the kids. I think they like being able to go upstairs and switch on something else.
Yeah. But I wonder if it actually created quite a lot of conflict.
I think it did.
Because, well, obviously conflict over which channel was going to be watched, but a lot of shows had to, in the 70s, they had to attract both the dads and the mums.
I was speculating about an hour ago about how TV programmes often avoid partisan politics. Well, I think now that may be changing in the sense that your commercial calculation is, well, if we try to appeal to everyone, we'll appeal to no one. Whereas if we go straight for a tiny audience, we'll get them. We've got a much better chance of getting them.
Is anyone making that calculation?
Well, on the internet, yes. I'm sure they are, yes. I think in America, very much so. In America, there is. I'm sure that they have this discussion at the level of the boardroom in Facebook and Google and all the rest of it, where they have a discussion which goes like this. Right-wing buffers are complaining about us being biased. What do we think we're going to do about that? And they discuss it, and an hour later they say, we're not going to do anything about it. We're going to be biased, because it's better business to satisfy half the audience really thoroughly than to piss off everyone. Because the right-wing buffers are going to have their own TV shows and their own social media sooner or later once they get their act together. Fuck them. I'm sure that that calculation is made quite consciously by American broadcasters especially. I think in Britain this effect is masked by we have laws against TV bias, don't we?
Yes.
Which I think is wrong. I think we should get rid of them. In America they have fewer such laws, as I understand it.
I think they have something called the Fairness Doctrine.
Do they?
Yeah. In for TV, and perhaps also radio as well, I don't know. And I think the complaint is that actually this ensures they're going to have a left-wing bias.
Yeah,
by various mechanisms.
Yes. That's another way of saying that the underlying commercial logic of being biased, which after all is what the British newspapers are, and they're allowed to be biased, and they're all biased.
Yes.
In all sorts of different directions. It seems to me that it makes sense for a firm like Google or Facebook to be biased.
Well, maybe it sounds like a dangerous game to play, but they're certainly playing the game at the moment.
But the point is that so is the attempt not to be biased. You could fall with a crash between both stools.
But aren't they doing different things? I mean, Facebook is essentially providing a platform.
Well,
anyone can put up anything. Well, or used to be able to.
Yes, but on the left, there is a strong opinion that right-wingers should be silenced. It's not universally believed in by all left-wingers, let's be clear, but it is believed in by a very vigorous minority.
Yeah.
And the question is, what do you do about this vigorous minority? Do you tell right-wingers to take a hike when they complain about being scrubbed off one of these platforms? Or do you tell the vigorous minority to take a hike? You've got to choose. You can't please both of them.
No, I see what you mean.
To me, the great joy of the internet is that it brings the age of biased TV into business with a huge eruption. It's just unstoppable.
So you mean the biased TV is becoming more biased, or that it is...
Well,
we're more aware of the bias.
There's lots of TV shows now on YouTube and on the internet, which is what we're doing, only with a camera as well. But whether it's just recording sound or vision doesn't matter. The point is, you and I both are very biased in favour of libertarianism.
Mm-hmm.
We believe in the private ownership of the means of production, distribution and exchange. And we believe that if you don't believe that, you're being stupid. You know, there was a time when that sort of thing was hard to say in public on the media.
Mm.
Now it's very easy.
Well, it was certainly very easy in the early days of the internet and the early days of blogging.
Mm.
But it seems, well, you it, could seems still, it seems to be getting well, harder.
Yeah, but you can still say it.
Yes.
I mean, it. You may not get as much traction out of it as you'd like. I mean, this reminds me of these tragic stories of Russian dissidents escaping from the USSR in the 80s, arriving in New York, writing vast essays about this or that, taking them to the New York Times and be told, no, we're not going to publish this. And they said, oh, my God, censorship here is just as bad as it is in Russia. Well, no, you can publish it. It's just that you can't force anyone else to read this stuff. But you can publish it. You won't be arrested for the simple act of printing it and standing at the street corner and saying, do you want to buy my pamphlet?
Hmm.
But you won't be. You can't commandeer the New York Times for 7 episodes.
No. Or Facebook or Twitter.
Or, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to be careful when you write for one of these social media that you won't inflame that minority who will proceed to ruin your life for a week or two. That's just the way of the world, it seems to me.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd be genuinely surprised if anyone stopped this from being put up on the internet.
That's true.
I mean, it would be bizarre, wouldn't it?
Although being libertarians, we're slightly less controversial than some others.
Oh, I see. Well, actually, that vocal minority would like to shut down the libertarian movement if it could.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
They would, no question. Yeah. And they keep calling it racist simply by saying something libertarian. No, you're revealing your inner racist when you say these things.
Well, yes,
you believe in freedom, you're accused of being a racist. I'm not saying this is... Nothing like half of America says things as ridiculous as this, but there is a force to fanaticism. It really counts for a lot what fanatics are doing and saying. It doesn't take many people to screw up a public meeting. 12 people can basically take it out, can't they? And 12 people can, if they organise themselves properly, can freak out a really quite big corporation. I mean, the number of people who wanted Hollywood not to have any even simulated sex in movies was pretty small in the 50s and 40s. But they managed it. They were organised and they were crazy about it. Determined to stop it. Yeah. Yeah. I can remember that much. I'm being old. I can remember when movies, you know, you had American couples living in bedrooms with separate beds, which wasn't what actually happened at all. And then it all just collapsed. Because people were just sick of it. It was so stupid. But what the point being that it doesn't take many people to change an atmosphere.
Right, but hopefully it also that it can collapse quite quickly.
Yeah.
Can you get fed up on it?